Welcome back to another episode of A Desi Woman Podcast. I am your host, Sonia Gokhale, and the voices I am seeking may have never been heard before, but their stories deserve to be told. What is a Desi woman? She is a dynamic, fearless, and strong woman. She is your mother, your grandmother, your daughter, your sister. She is every one of us who is on an endless pursuit of self-empowerment and fulfillment. I am Sonia Gokhale, and I am a Desi woman. Hello, and welcome to another edition of A Desi Woman Podcast. I am your host, Sonia Gokhale, and today we are so excited to be joined by Luisa Grieva. Luisa Grieva is the Director of Global Advocacy for the Uyghur Human Rights Project. Previously, Ms. Grieva was Vice President for Programs and East Asia Director at the National Endowment for Democracy. With past experience at Special Olympics International, the Corporation for National and Community Service, and the United Nations Development Program. She is an experienced nonprofit advisor and an expert on human rights in China, having traveled and worked in China since 1980. Her first visit to East Turkestan was in 1988. She currently serves as Washington Fellow for CSW, an advocacy group promoting freedom of religion or belief for all peoples and faiths. Ms. Grieva has served on the Amnesty International USA Board of Directors, the Virginia Advisory Committee of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, the International Advisory Committee of the Coalition to End Transplant Abuse in China, and the Liberties Promise Board of Directors. She is the author of several book chapters on ethnic issues and human rights in China, and has testified before Congress on democracy in Asia. Luisa, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Some of my following questions are based on a submission by the UHRP to the UN Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in advance of the 66th pre-sessional working group of the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights relating to China's third cycle review and compliance with the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and was issued in December of 2020. In addition to internment camps of Uyghurs, which I will be addressing in subsequent questions, the Chinese government has exported an estimated 80,000 Uyghur laborers to other parts of China in factories under conditions which strongly indicate forced labor. The availability of Uyghur labor to factories outside of the Uyghur region is widely known amongst China's managerial class. Publicly accessible websites allow factory bosses to quote-unquote bulk purchase Uyghur labor for use in their manufacturing facilities outside of the Uyghur region, with one online advertisement claiming to be able to provide, quote, 1,000 Uyghur workers aged 16 to 18 years, end quote, with a description that read, "The advantages of Xinjiang workers are semi-military style management, can withstand hardship, no loss of personnel, minimum order 100 workers. Luisa, this is unbelievable and unimaginable, and a living example of modern day slavery and servitude. And I can scarcely believe this is occurring on this planet right now in China. It should be noted that U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged all nations to join the U.S. in demanding an end to these dehumanizing abuses. However, can you offer some more insights on this unthinkable advertisement of human labor and oppression of this group? And why isn't anything being done to stop this in its tracks by first world countries and other advocacy groups? And what are the obstacles that humanitarian organizations such as yours face in addressing this atrocity?
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm really appreciate your passion. The scale of forced labor truly is shocking. The dehumanization, taking people away from their families. I mean, there's even one additional implication, which is, Did you think about those ages? 16 to 18, right? And 16 is a legal working age in China, but it just seems incredible that the government of China, which is very proud of modernity, which promotes an international image of a very capable, you know, high-tech society, very advanced, better at containing COVID, they say, better at having things like contactless payment, right? You don't even, your phone is your wallet, all those things which haven't even come to the U.S., China's there, and so China's superior. And yet at the same time, you'll have these shipments of workers as if they're disposable objects to be used for labor with, and then again, the semi-militarized training or supervision, right? So minders are coming with these young women and men being taken away from their families. Policy responses. Let's talk about that. The U.S., I must say, has finally taken some great actions, both with import bans, not to allow goods made by these products into the U.S., export bans, not allowing American, mostly in the tech sector, American tech sectors cannot sell products to the government agencies enforcing this horrific system of concentration camps and massive forced labor. But one problem is with our complex supply chains in our modern globalized world, how do you know whether that cotton sheet from IKEA or that Nike pair of Nike shoes, first, was it made in China? Okay, the label says China, but then how do you know which factory it came from? So this is where cotton is really important because the Xinjiang region, the East Turkestan, is a major site of cotton production. Actually, over 80% of China's cotton is grown there, which tells you one thing, it's a major reason for complete environmental devastation there. But it also means that if you do the calculations, 1 in 5 cotton garments sold worldwide is grown there in this region where people are being forced to pick the cotton by hand for no pay and where the processing factories are using, you know, these batches of laborers. So its complexity makes it hard to act. And this has been a big excuse, we must say, for governments and for private sector. You know, the big companies, what do they use for marketing now? Sustainability, right? Social responsibility. And they're marketing organic cotton. And there was even cotton from the Uyghur region being marketed as organic. Perhaps that's true. But the same companies that adhere to growing things in a way that's good for the environment also adhere to standards against modern slavery. And that was being completely ignored despite abundant evidence. But now that the media has taken so much effort in documenting what's happening, the big companies are waking up. And so for the companies, I will say that there's one easy thing they can do. They can sign a pledge that's been created by a very big coalition of labor rights groups and Uyghur groups. It's called the Coalition to End Forced Labor in the Uyghur Region. There's a brand commitment. Any company can just sign this commitment and then work with us over a whole year. It's expected that it may take a company an entire year to ensure that all their sourcing is not complicit with this system of forced labor. I think in many cases, it's so complicated there in China that they may have to stop sourcing from China altogether. But that's what their own policies say. And so they really do need to sign up. And that's why you'll see, if you look around, this is something people can do. Use the hashtag forced labor fashion. Hashtag forced labor fashion, actually spelled in the British way. So labor should be spelled L-A-B-O-U-R because it's a global campaign, not an American campaign. And you'll see Zara and Nike and other companies being called out for claiming that they oppose modern slavery, but then doing nothing to say, yes, we will take the steps needed to find out exactly who our second and third tier suppliers are so that we're not profiting from modern slaves, the Uyghur Muslims. And unfortunately, well, I should say it's a victory. One big brand just signed on last week, which is Marks & Spencer in the UK, a very popular brand there. This company signed. And then some smaller niche brands like Eileen Fisher, known for a sustainable production, has definitely signed. And what our coalition, which has over 300 rights groups as members, we're telling companies, this is something you need to sign. It's been out for 6 months, actually, already since July of this past year. And so it's time for them to step up. And in addition, other governments need to do like what the U.S. has done. Actually, just last week, the U.S. took an additional step and banned all cotton from the Uyghur region and all tomato products. And then in the U.K. and in Canada, the parliamentary committees have launched inquiries, very official inquiries, not just a hearing like in the U.S. where you have maybe a 2 or 3 hour hearing, but multi-day, multi-week research effort with several days of hearings with dozens of witnesses. And then putting together policy recommendations within the parliamentary system for the prime minister to carry out. And so that really needs to happen. It can't just be a U.S. effort.
Well, I think that's wonderful. And I am going to have those links in the podcast notes. So for any listeners who may think, wow, this is horrific, there's nothing I can do. Actually, you've just heard otherwise. And I often seek out some of the brands you mentioned, but I'm going to think twice now, because this is a way that we can actually do something from our local communities and cities. And it directs back to what we purchase and asking, where is it sourced from? So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Well, another thing that might happen is, you know, some listeners, they might belong to either their church or mosque or synagogue, or perhaps in their own retirement funds, right? Some people check that box. I want a human rights screen for my, let's say, an index fund for some of my savings, if you have a stock index fund. Those investors' investments are not screened for this issue. So actually, for anyone who's really outraged, it would be really, really great to at least go to the company that holds a retirement account or your pension and say, I want to know, I don't want to profit from Uyghur forced labor. What are you doing to keep those companies that engage with it out of my savings? And if you belong to a church or a mosque or synagogue, very often there's a socially responsible investment committee. That committee needs to hear from individual members to say, have we endorsed this coalition to end Uyghur forced labor? Let's sign up. There's just a link on the website. It's easy to do. So at least there's an endorsement. And then there's information about how to make sure that ethically managed investment fund is not profiting from this crime against humanity.
Other systematic abuses, which are part of your report, include the mass arbitrary detention of at least 1 million Uyghurs and other Turkic people, and a program to, quote, cleanse Uyghurs of their extremist thoughts through re-education and forced labor. China's campaign involves exploiting the labor of Uyghurs detained in internment camps, as well as through coerced labor across several regions in China. It is unquestionably clear that China is engaging in a focused campaign to eradicate Uyghur culture, religion, and language through policy and practice, including the destruction of sacred cultural and religious sites such as mosques, cemeteries, and shrines. In fact, UHRP conducted its own month-long geospatial analysis investigation, and you calculated that between 10,000 and 15,000 Uyghur religious sites have been destroyed or damaged by the Chinese government since 2016. A separate study focused on quantifying the damage to Uyghur mosques in particular, which calculated that over 8,500 mosques across the Uyghur region have been demolished by the Chinese government since 2017. This represents over one-third of the region's total mosques. Chinese officials have acknowledged that these quote-unquote renovations constitute a part of China's strategic 5-year plan to guide Islam to be compatible with socialism. So my question for you, Louisa, is can you explain why the Uyghur culture is a threat to the People's Republic of China? Why would the destruction of historical, cultural, archaeological, and religious sites, some of which go back thousands of years, be a threat to the powerhouse that is China? And what does this do to the indigenous community and culture of the Uyghurs?
It's almost too sad to even talk about it. Hundreds of years of history are being destroyed as part of the destruction of the Uyghur people. You put your finger on it. Uyghurs are overwhelmingly Muslim. Many villages have maybe one or two little mosques. People gather to pray. It's a community center. And these have been emptied out. And many of the more historic and beautiful with unique local architecture. They have elements from different parts of the world. They are not necessarily copies of let's say, Arab architectural features or other places really locally designed. Their destruction is, it tells you something, right? And when UHRP, my organization, the Uyghur Human Rights Project, we issued our report on the destruction of mosques, first of all, we called that report, we called out what was happening. And when we presented the report at a public event, at a sort of a panel discussion with some experts, the Washington Post editorial writer wrote a piece, took up almost a half a page of the print paper. And this is his title: "In China, every day is Kristallnacht." Taking us back to the 1930s, when the Nazi government was systematically discriminating against and labeling and making making Jews wear badges, kicking them out of professions, kicking them out of the civil service, restricting their business opportunities, restricting their movements before the ghettos were created. And Kristallnacht was that night, November 1938, when thugs were organized to, you know, the night of the broken glass, to smash Jewish businesses as part of the dehumanization and eradication of Jewish communities. And that included hundreds of synagogues smashed and looted. And so for this writer, who's himself Jewish, it just was a shocking throwback to the most terrible Holocaust of our time and in all of modern memory. And so that was the report that triggered his thought that if you're going to start going around destroying mosques on a systematic scale, locking up the imams and their entire families, this tells you something about the genocidal nature of the government's program.
The Chinese embassy has received global backlash based on a tweet they issued last week on January 7th, whereby they proudly announced that Muslim women in Xinjiang province are no longer baby-making machines, and that the decrease in population growth throughout the province has led to a drop in terrorism. There were universal demands to have the tweet removed. However, this leads us into arguably one of the most disturbing aspects of the UHRP report, and it pertains to China's use of forced sterilizations and coerced IUD implants on Uyghur women. Many observers have classified this as absolutely meeting the threshold of acts constitutive of genocide under the UN Convention, which forbids measures intended to reduce births. Since at least 2016, the government of China has made efforts to purposely reduce the birth rate of Uyghur women through coercive family planning, including the forced sterilization of women. In 2018, 80% of all net added IUD placements in China were performed in the Uyghur region, despite the fact that the region only makes up 1.8% of the nation's population, one of the most populated countries in the entire world, I might add. Birth rates among Uyghur women plummeted from 2015 to 2018, with population growth in the Uyghur region falling by over 84% in that period in the last two Uyghur prefectures. In 2020, Chinese authorities in one Uyghur prefecture set a, quote, near zero birth rate target. However, what's even more insidiously troubling is that there is evidence that China's sterilization policies go beyond mothers who may have violated state-enforced birth limits across China, and increasingly target all Uyghur women. So my question for you, Louisa, is can you speak to this issue and UHRP's work on this matter?
What can I say with being a little bit repetitive here? It's so shocking to realize that the state's plan is going so far as to gradually eliminate the possibility of Uyghur babies being born. So individual women forced to abort their babies, forced to be sterilized against their will. And, you know, one question people might have is, why don't you hear about it? Well, as we discussed, to complain about government mistreatment is to be accused of, quote, violating harmony or being a troublemaker. And then, you know, you're just taken away with a black hood over your head to one of these camps. And so this has been happening for quite a while, but there are this, of course, accelerated the reduction of births. It's both because of these horrific violence to women, and in addition, structural situation where young people are being taken away to locked conditions in factories, forced to work in factories, where families are separated so that not only are the parents or one or both parents in camps, they're the number statistics show just short of 900,000 Uyghur children. Total population, according to the census, is 12 million Uyghurs in their homeland in 2015. Short of 900,000 children are in boarding school, not because of the parents' choice, but because they're told this is the only school, or because they are orphaned. One or both parents are taken away. So those children are being raised how? They're forbidden to speak their own language. So they're speaking Chinese, not Uyghur. I'm sure it's great to learn Chinese, but not when you're locked up and punished for speaking, you know, your parents' language. So those children are being grown up where their parent is the state. And so what happens in 10 years when those people, you know, if they're still alive, if they're let out into society, will they marry another Uyghur person or will they be marrying a Chinese person? And then that baby will have not be a Uyghur. So the really Uyghurs fear that very soon there will be no more Uyghur babies born. This will achieve the goal of stopping not only, you know, births from Uyghur women, but really prevent the transmission of the people to another generation.
It is just unbelievable that our time together has come to an end. And I did want to share the beautiful sentiments that you had offered to me as we scheduled this podcast recording for today. This episode appropriately coincides with the holiday in the United States to commemorate the prolific civil rights activist, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He has so many prolific and inspiring quotes, but the one that speaks to me most about your work and that of UHRP would be that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we see and we hear the injustices occurring to the Uyghur people. And I have to say, I will not stop talking about it with you and your organization until justice and humanity prevail. We cannot thank you enough, Louisa Grieva, for joining us today.
Sonia, your concern, your compassion, and your bringing to light this hidden horror just shows that a light is shining from you. And absolutely, this is an inspiration we can take from Martin Luther King Jr., who stood up and was able to push back against a systematic injustice in the U.S. And we truly appreciate international concern for the Uyghurs who are struggling alone and in the dark in their homeland.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Louisa. And I can, if you'll come back, we will have you again as many times as possible so we can raise awareness for these amazing Uyghur people and their beautiful culture. Thank you so much, Louisa Grieva.
Thank you, Sonia.